Donc, j'ai le grand plaisir de vous présenter Naama Friedman de l'Université de Tel Aviv. Naama est une grande linguiste expérimentale qui a fait du travail expérimental avec beaucoup de populations distinctes, avec les enfants qui apprennent la première langue dont nous parlons dans le cours, dans différents cas de pathologie du langage. Troubles spécifiques du langage, par exemple, dyslexie. Naama a créé un modèle extrêmement sophistiqué de dyslexie qui donne une typologie détaillée de ce type de problème. Enfants sourds, langue des signes, pathologie de l'adulte, donc différents types d'aphasie. Par exemple. Donc, beaucoup de domaines expérimentaux ont été visités par Naama avec des résultats souvent spectaculaires. Et je dirais que l'étoile polaire de sa recherche expérimentale est toujours l'ensemble d'études théoriques, fondamentalement. Et donc, son activité expérimentale est toujours guidée par des modèles théoriques, par des idées théoriques. Donc c'est avec grand plaisir que je lui donne la parole. Merci d'être ici. Et bienvenue.
Merci bien. Bonjour à tous. I'm sorry, this is most of my French, so I'll move to English. Today I'm very, very happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation. And today I'm going to talk about critical periods, and specifically about a critical period for the acquisition of syntax in the first language. And when we talk about critical periods, this is a very long-studied issue, because in various species we know that there are time windows. So there are sensitive time windows for acquisition of various skills. So, for example, from the work of Konrad Lorenz, we know that there is imprinting on goslings. So when the goslings hatch, a few hours after they hatch, they identify who their mother is, and it might be them, indeed their mother, but it might be Konrad Lorenz who is walking in front of them, or it might be a very big white ball. But in a few hours, they get attached to this big object. However, if it's a day later, they don't get attached to anything like that anymore. So it's a time window that is very specific for a specific acquisition of, in this case, attachment or imprinting. We know that for songbirds, there is a very similar critical period for the acquisition of local songs. So birds are born with some general song, but to learn the song of their neighborhood, they need to be exposed to it. And again, there is a critical period of, in the case of white-crowned sparrows, it's 10 to 50 days after they hatch. And if they are in isolation, or if they are exposed to this song before the age of 10 days, or after around the age of 100 days, they do not learn the local song anymore. The same with the cats. David Hubel and David Hubel and Thorsten Wiesel, learned about the organization of the neurons for ocular dominance, and they found out that when cats are exposed or are not exposed to visual stimuli in one of their eyes in the first 3 months of their lives, then they do not develop the ocular dominance for input from this eye. So there is a time window in which several species can acquire new skills, and if they acquire it well, and if they acquire these skills later, then they are less, either they do not acquire it at all, or they are less proficient in it. And what I want to do today is talk about very similar thing in language. I'm not going to go into the mechanisms, but there are beautiful studies now talking about the mechanisms of these critical periods, talking about how the critical period opens, how the critical period the time of the sensitive time of the period of acquisition, and they talk about the molecular breaks that allow for the closure. And later we're going to talk about what exactly it means for language to have similar mechanisms. And today I'm going to talk about mainly about data from language input and how important language input is during the critical period for the acquisition of the first language. I'm going to talk mainly about children who do not get enough language input because they are hearing impaired and they do not use sign language. And I'm going to talk a little bit about brain development and children who have problems in brain development during the critical period because they have TME deficiency. So I'm going to show you data from hearing impairment. So individuals who are not exposed to language during the critical period for language, and from brain development, children who did not have the nutrition that was required to the development of the brain during the critical period, and what it in what way it affects their later development of syntax. When I talk about it, so most of the talk today is going to be about children with hearing impairment. And I'm going to talk about, first of all, about specific syntactic impairments in this population, and it is going to tie very well with the talk that you have just heard from Professor Rizzi. Then I'm going to compare individuals who had early exposure to language during the critical period for language and late exposure. I'm going to talk about a little bit about children who were exposed to language in the beginning and then became deaf. I'm going to compare individuals who have bilateral hearing loss and hearing loss only in one ear. And I'm going to ask what happens when children receive input during the critical period, but not in a spoken language, but in a sign language. So this is the plan for today. So the majority is going to be about syntactic impairments in this population of individuals with hearing impairment. And almost all of this work is with these two wonderful researchers. They used to be my master's and PhD students, and now they are doctors, Dr. Ronit Sterman and Dr. Manar Haddad Hanna. With Ronit is all the work on Hebrew, and with Manar is all the work on Palestinian Arabic. So just to give you an example of what it means for a child to have deficits in syntax, and specifically in movement. And you have just heard from Professor Rizzi about these non-local structures, and these are the structures that I'm going to focus on today. So when we show a child this beautiful picture, and we asked her, which dog does the cat bite? This is the answer that we got. That's hard. This one, pointing to the left. Right? No, this one, pointing to the other one. Say it again, please. And then I say, which dog does the cat bite? And she says, how? They don't say. So for her, the sentence doesn't include the information about which of the dogs we are talking about. So what happens here? She understands dog, she understands cat, she understands bite, but she doesn't really, she can't get the syntactic information from the sentence to guide her to point to one dog or the other. And you can already see that it's these kind of structures. Which dog does the cat bite? So the cat bites the dog, and then the dog moves to the beginning of the sentence. Another kind of task, sentence repetition task. This is a boy, a 9-year-old boy with hearing impairment. I say the sentence, and he hears the sentence because he has two hearing aids on his ears. And I ask him to repeat the sentence. So for example, for a sentence like, which teacher does the boy like? He says, which boy, which he likes? He likes teacher, which he likes teacher? So I didn't ask to explain the sentence, I just asked him to repeat the sentence. But when we repeat sentences, we have to understand them and then produce them. And because he wasn't able to represent the sentence, he wasn't able to repeat it. And you can see that something similar happens in the second sentence. I say, this teacher, the girl found. And he says, this teacher, she found the girl. So again, he knows that there is a teacher and finding finding event and the girl, but he really doesn't understand who does what to whom. So who is the agent and who is the theme? And therefore, he is unable to repeat the sentence. And you can see that it happens with other sentences here, but look at the blue ones, the cold color, the blue and the lavender ones, he is able to repeat them. So what is the difference between the blue and the lavender colored sentences and the other and the more brightly colored sentences? Let's put it like that, it will be easier. You can see that the top sentences include this kind of A-bar movement that Professor Ritti has just discussed, where we have movement of the object across the subject to the beginning of the sentence. What about this sentence? It has exactly the same number of words. It's not a problem of hearing, it's not a problem of memory, because he was able to repeat this sentence. But it doesn't include this kind of movement with intervention. So we can see that another demonstration of the difficulty with this kind of structure is a problem in repeating these sentences. So when we think about these kind of sentences, we see that a sentence like the woman drew the girl is easy, but which woman did the girl draw is more difficult. And why? Because the second sentence includes a bar movement, in which we have movement from the object position to the beginning of the sentence. So in a sentence like which woman did the girl draw, you see the which woman moving across the girl. If you want to talk about trees, I always want to talk about trees, then you can represent it as movement to the top of the tree, right? To the left periphery or to CP. And we just heard about intervention, and that intervention is acquired later for typically developing children. It is also acquired later, or not acquired, for children with developmental syntactic impairments. And what I want to suggest is that children with hearing impairment who were not exposed to language during the critical period for the acquisition of syntax also have this kind of problem with structures with this kind of intervention, with non-local movement. So if we compare, for example, two kinds of relative clauses, subject relatives, where we do have movement but it doesn't cross anything, to object relatives, where there is movement that crosses an intervener, in this case the girl. So if you look at the second sentence, we have the grandma moving to the beginning of, it's your side, so grandma moving to the beginning of the sentence, crossing the girl. The girl intervenes here and makes it harder to understand the sentence. The same happens with WH questions. So which girl kissed grandma does not involve this kind of non-local movement, but which grandma did the girl kiss? We have grandma again moving across an intervener, the girl. Another kind of structure that has the same structure is object topicalization, something like this grandma the girl kissed. In some languages it sounds better than in others, so we have here movement of the object across the subject. So if we look at the tree, we have movement of an object to the left periphery across an intervener. And these structures are difficult for individuals with hearing impairment, as I'll show you in a second, to produce and to understand. So when we think about production, maybe this is the picture that we need to draw. Maybe when we think about comprehension, we have to represent this sentence. Here, the phrase, which woman, in the beginning of the sentence, and then search for where this which woman came from, right? And if there is an intervener, it impairs the search in some way. So that's comprehension. And sometimes we might think that which woman, So we have these three kinds of structures. We have topicalization structure, we have relative clause, object relative, and we have an object question. In all these structures, there is intervention, and there is quite a lot of work showing that individuals with hearing impairment who are orally trained, who do not use sign language, have troubles with these kind of structures. And I'm going to, some of this work is ours, and I'm going to show you some of these results. So I'm going to show you work on the comprehension of these structures, the production of these structures, relative clauses, WH questions, and topicalization. So they are all structures that involve this kind of movement of the object across the subject, non-local movement. And then we'll ask, why do children with hearing impairment have problems with these kind of structures? And the data comes from quite a lot of children who were kind enough to participate in this quest. So we have 106 Hebrew-speaking children with a binaural hearing impairment, so hearing impairment in both ears, who were orally trained, which means that they set their families speaking. 90% of the families, of the parents of hearing impaired children are hearing. So there was no sign language at home, there was no sign language in classes. They sat in regular classes with spoken language, and they were deaf from birth. And I want to say something about, sometimes it's described as prelingually deaf. So apparent, as if they were deaf before they had language. Now, I think you heard Gislaine DeAnne's talk right last week. There's no stage in which a child is prelingual. So there is evidence that even there is language in uterus, right? There is evidence that there is language in the very first days when the child is born. There is a theory saying that we are born with some universal grammar. So there is no stage where a child is prelingual. So I do not like to use this term, and I recommend not to use the term prelingually deaf. But I would say that they are deaf from birth. So there was no stage at which they were hearing the language around them, until they got their cochlear implant or hearing aids. So these are the Hebrew speakers. The Palestinian Arabic speakers were 124 participants. Again, they were not exposed to sign language. They were all orally trained, and we compared children who were binaurally impaired compared to monaurally. So they had either bilateral hearing loss or hearing loss only in one ear. And now to the data. What did we find? So first of all, we looked at comprehension, whether these children in Hebrew, in Palestinian Arabic, whether they are able to understand structures that involve this kind of non-local movement of object in object relatives, in object questions, and in topicalization structures. And we were using, two kinds of jump to the results. Now you know everything. We're using two kinds of pictures. One is two pictures, one above the other, with reversed roles. So for example, when a sentence was something like, show me the woman that the girl draws, an object relative clause, we have a picture of a girl drawing a woman and a woman drawing a girl, right? And if, as we said before, we suspect that they don't understand who is the agent and who is the theme of this drawing, then they will not know if they should point to the top one or to the bottom one. To make it, we thought maybe it would be pragmatically more plausible to use three pictures with one elephant washing a boy who's washing another elephant, and then we say, show me the elephant that the boy washes. So we looked at these kind of pictures as well, and here they had to point to the right figure in the picture. And what did we do? We compared subject relatives and object relatives. Recall that in the object relatives we have movement with intervention, and in the subject relatives we have a bar movement, but it's not with intervention. And we always include in these studies a simple sentence or simple sentences. Why do we include simple sentences? First of all, we want to make sure that they understand the words. We want to make sure that they understand the pictures. And there is also the smile factor. We want them to smile from time to time. We don't want them to be frustrated all the time. And this is why we always include sentences that we think they will understand and they will feel comfortable with. Okay? So, and now we check how they understand the different structures. And this is what we find. I tried the, in all the slides, the interesting pattern is always the interesting population. So here the interesting pattern in orange is the hearing impaired population. And in lavender you see the controls. And in this case it's first grade control, so 6 to 7 year olds. Okay? And what you can see is that in Hebrew speakers, 6 to 7 year olds are already very good in object relatives and in subject relatives, but the children with the hearing impairment do not understand this kind of object relatives. So they have difficulty in understanding the object relatives. And you can see that it's not exactly in 50%. And I'll tell you in a second why it's not exactly 50%, right? They had two options, the top or the bottom picture. Still, they are a little bit above 50%. And remember that it's a group average. So if we tell them, show me the girl that the woman is drawing, they don't know if they should point to the top or the bottom picture. The same pattern we see with the other kind of picture. So an elephant washing, a boy who's washing another elephant, show me the elephant that the boy is washing. They don't understand these object relatives. Compared to the controls, they are very impaired. And this is what they would say. In Hebrew, we are lucky enough to have a verb for cutting hair. So this is why this may be a strange sentence. But the sentence is, show me the girl that the woman cuts her hair. And then this participant with hearing impairment says, I didn't understand the girl. What? And then I say the sentence again. Something here, strange sentences. They usually try to educate me along the way and tell me that, you know, I shouldn't bring strange sentences to the table. The girl cuts hair. I didn't understand anything. Okay, and then he decides to go for a different way of... He'll just explain to me what's going on in the picture, and I'll figure it out by myself, and he explains in the picture. Here is a woman who cuts hair to this girl, so a subject relative, and she cuts her hair, and she cuts her hair, okay? So I really don't know. So you see, he understands the picture, he knows exactly what's going on, he just can't answer the question, the girl, point to the girl that the woman cuts her hair, okay? And why wasn't it exactly on 50%? And this is very important for the critical period issue. Not all children were impaired in this structure. There were 38 children who were fine, who understood these sentences fine. And there were 28 children who were impaired in this structure. And this is our role, right? We don't need only to look at the whole group and say there is an impairment. We need to explain this kind of very important variation. And I'll give you a hint now that it has everything to do with critical periods. Okay, what about WH questions? We said that also in WH questions we have structures with intervention. So which dog does the cat bite has intervention, an object moving across the subject. Again, we see that these children had difficulties with these structures like which dog does the cat bite. It involves movement, and they don't understand it. And again, you see that they are not at 50%, so you can guess that the average is hiding an important variation here. And indeed, in this task, we had 23 children who did understand this structure, right? And 21 children who did not. The final structure for this kind of comprehension tasks is the topicalization structure, an OVS, object-verb-subject structure, like this cat, the dog bites. And again, we see the same picture. The orange, the hearing-impaired children are in orange, and you see that they fail to understand these topicalization structures. So if we sum up this comprehension tasks with the sentence picture matching, we see that they cannot understand object relatives, object WH, which questions, and topicalization structures. So there is a deficit here, but another important thing that we see is that there is variation. So there are some children in this group who are able to understand these structures. We did exactly the same tests in Arabic, in Palestinian Arabic. The only difference was that in Arabic, in Palestinian Arabic, there are two orders of the subject and the verb that are quite frequent. So you could either say, "Ilbint aklat hummus," the girl ate hummus, but you could also say, "Aklat ilbint hummus," ate the girl hummus. I know that in French the example was un gâteau, but here it's hummus because it's Arabic. And you can, so we use both kind of structures. So we compared subject relatives to object relatives with the order subject verb, and to object relatives with the order verb subject. Okay? And again, the picture is very, very similar. You can see that they fail to understand structures that involve intervention, both in SV and VS order, but they are fine with the subject questions. Also, the same with topicalization structure. They fail to understand structures that involve movement with intervention, and they are fine with the simple sentences. Another way that we used in order to assess comprehension was to see maybe when they see the sentence in front of them in unlimited time, maybe they can look at the sentence and then understand what is going on in the sentence. And this is also because some people say, because maybe hearing impaired children have a problem with phonological working memory. So here the sentence is in front of their eyes. They see the sentence and they just have to explain what is going on in their own words. Who is, if the sentence is, "I saw the cat that the dog licked," who is licking? Who is licking whom? And again, this is in Palestinian Arabic. Actually, no, this is in standard Arabic because it's written. And what you can see here is that the simple structures were completely fine. The structures with topicalization, they could not explain them in their own words. And the structures with object relative, they could not understand and could not explain in their own words. They did not have a problem with explaining, they did not have a problem in the task, because they were fine in the simple sentences. They just failed to understand and explain the more complex sentences, the sentences with movement. So this is just showing it in comparison to controls, and you can see very clearly that they have deficit also in explaining written sentences. And what do they say when they fail to understand the sentence? This is, for example, a sentence that a girl, she was 12 years old, a Hebrew speaker. I just skipped the chart for Hebrew, but it's the same. And she says, the sentence was, "The puppy that the boy wants eats chicken soup." And she says, "That's hard." And I ask her, "What's hard?" She said, "Well, deciding who eats the soup." And I ask her, "Who can it be?" And she says, "Well, either the boy or the puppy, I don't know." So she sees the sentence, she sees there is a puppy and there is a boy and someone is eating chicken soup, but she can't gather from the sentence who is the one who's doing the chicken soup eating. Okay, so you can see that even when they read sentences, they find it very hard to understand. So maybe you can start and think what happens when these sentences are put into paragraphs and into books. How do they understand texts when they have to read the text? And this is a relatively recent study with Ulrich Telman from 2020, where what we did was looking at paragraphs with syntactic movement and then comparing it to the exact same paragraph, written paragraph, that did not include A-bar movement. No A-bar movement and no V2C movement. So, when you think about reading comprehension, I don't know how much you see children with diagnosis, but in Israel it's quite common for a child to have a diagnosis of reading comprehension problem. When I see a child with reading comprehension problem, I just understand that there is a problem, but I don't understand what the problem is. Because when a child has a reading comprehension problem, it might be a reading problem, but it might be a comprehension problem, right? So it just means that we need to find out whether they have dyslexia, whether they have a problem in reading, and whether they have a problem in comprehension, and if they have a problem in comprehension, what kind of structures are difficult for them? Do they have a problem in understanding the words? Do they have a problem in understanding the syntactic structure? And if it is the syntactic structure, what exactly is the characteristic of the kind of sentences that they fail to understand? So what we did was comparing paragraphs with movement and paragraphs with A-bar and V2C movement to paragraphs without Abar and V2C movement. So the stories, not very interesting stories, I must admit, but the stories were similar, very similar, except for the fact that one of them was cast in sentences with intervention, and the other was cast without Abar movement and V2C movement. So in one, for example, the travelers that the monkeys surprised were happy at first. You can see here the movement. And it was compared to the bunch of monkeys surprised the group of travelers. The travelers were happy first. And we asked them to read aloud the paragraph, and then we asked comprehension questions. And the first striking finding is that even when they read aloud, we can see that they have a problem, even though in reading single words they have no problem. So we tested first, we tested their reading of single words, and then we tested the reading aloud of these paragraphs. Even and all but six of these children did not have any problem in reading single words. But when they were reading paragraphs with WH movement, with A-bar movement, they made reading aloud errors. So even reading aloud is affected by not understanding the sentence. And you can see the hearing impaired children in comparison to the controls. When we take the hearing impaired children and divide them into two groups, one group of hearing impaired children with impairment in A-bar movement, and one group of children with hearing impairment whose syntax is fine, we can see that the ones who make errors in reading aloud the text with movement are only the ones with poor syntax, right? So their reading errors are not dyslexia. Their reading errors are a result of not understanding the sentence and not being able to, and therefore not being able to read them aloud. And most of the errors were in paragraphs with syntactic movement, and especially in the sentences with syntactic movement. So especially in the object-relative clauses, and object-topicalization. So just to give you an example of what kind of reading errors they make, the sentence was the frightened travelers that the monkeys attacked ran away, and this and several children read it aloud as the frightened travelers that the monkeys attacked and ran away. Right? So they don't understand that the monkeys attacked the travelers, and then they try to make this sentence make sense in some way by adding a coordination marker. Okay, so what we can see here is that we saw that there is a problem in comprehension of heard sentences, of written sentences, and of paragraphs. Okay, what about the production? So we see that they cannot understand these structures. How do they produce these structures? Now, if you think for a second, it's not completely easy to make a child who has problems with relative clauses, for example, produce a relative clause. You have to encourage them in a very specific way so they will say something like the elephant that the monkey washes. Right? So we came up with this preference task that works quite well from the age of 3 to the age of, I think, 92 is the oldest that I tried. So we say something like, imagine there are two children, two girls. One girl gives a present, one girl receives a present. Which girl would you rather be? Please start with the girl, and then the target would be the girl who receives a present. And you will be surprised how kind children are and how many children say that they would rather give a present. If it's true or not, I know, it's left to inquire, but for us, the important part is to see whether they are able to produce a relative clause. So in this case, it's a subject relative. We can also, in the same way, try to encourage them to produce an object relative. So, for example, imagine there are two children. The father wakes up one child. The alarm clock wakes up one child. Which child would you rather be? And here we get a lot of none of them. So we actually change this item. But the target would be the child that the father wakes up, right? And then we can see the production of an object relative. And with this task, we find that they have severe difficulties in the production, especially of object relatives. And importantly for the critical period issue, there is a variation. So there were 69 children who were tested in this experiment, were tested with the preference task. 38 of them failed to produce the object relatives, but the other 31 could produce the object relatives. So what makes this huge difference between the ones who fail and the ones who succeed? Just to give you some examples, this is actually it's the same guy that you saw in the beginning in the repetition task. Just here he is a bit older, and the task very relevant for what you experienced here in the weekend in Paris. There are two boys. The air conditioning cools down one boy. The air conditioning warms up one boy. Which boy would you rather be? And he says, well, I'd rather be the air conditioning that warms up one boy. So for him, it was very easy to select warming up or cooling down, but he couldn't produce a sentence, I'd rather be the boy that the air conditioning cools down. And then he produces a subject relative instead of an object relative. Actually, it's the same boy when he was younger, when he was 8 and 5 months, and with the item with the alarm clock and the father, and he says, I would rather be a boy that has an alarm clock that it rings. Okay? Again, he knows exactly what he wants. He just cannot produce an object relative, and he produces a chain of subject relatives instead. In Arabic, we see the same picture. In Palestinian Arabic, we see problems in the production of object relatives and better production of subject relatives. And just to tell you that you, I know that it's less legible than you would want, but just to tell you that even when they have to write down these sentences, we see very similar errors. So this is a child who was required to color the picture, write a title, and then explain in writing what happens in this picture. And he says, for the Hebrew readers, this is the area, Maya chose the boots that she likes best, the shoes. Right? And then it was he was with Ronit Sterman, and Ronit asked him, why do you say the shoes again in the end of the sentence? And he said, you told me not to say the same word twice in the sentence. So instead of boots, he said shoes. But the structure was an irregular, let's say, ungrammatical structure of an object relative. Okay, just the final task that I'm going to discuss is sentence repetition, a great task to examine syntax and also lexical abilities, because as we said, in order to repeat a sentence, you have to understand it and then produce it. And what we did here was comparing simple sentences to relative clauses and WH which questions, and we also added embedded sentences. Why? Because we were interested in whether these children, you heard in Professor Ritzi's talk before about the growing trees versus movement and intervention. So the question is whether they had a problem in the left periphery. These children have problems in the left periphery, and then we would expect also problems in repetition of embedded sentences like Daddy said that Grandpa is sleeping, or whether the problem is indeed only in this movement with intervention, in which case embedded declaratives should not be problematic. And what we saw, and this is again average of the whole group, we see that simple sentences and embedding sentential complements of verbs are not problematic, but object relatives and object questions are problematic. So they cannot even repeat these kind of sentences. But again, there is variation, an important variation. First of all, we see that there is variation between structures. So we see that embedded structures are usually better than object relatives and object questions. We also see that there are some children who fail to even repeat embedded structures. This is not for the talk today, but there are some children within this group of hearing impaired children who we think have a deficit in the left periphery. They have a deficit in building the syntactic structure up to its highest layers. And finally, we see that not all children have deficits in repeating this kind of structure. So out of 53 children, there were 20, 30 children who had difficulties in repeating these structures, but not all of them. And now we get to the big question. Okay? So we see in each task, I think I showed you that in each of the tasks, in comprehension and production and repetition, there is a deficit in at the group level in structures with movement. But I also showed you that there is in each of these tasks, there was variation. So not all the children were impaired. And now the big question is, why should a child who has hearing impairment have syntactic problems, right? And secondly, why are some children succeeding and others don't? So what exactly characterizes the ones who succeed versus the ones who fail to understand and produce a bar movement? So we think that the way we approach this question is by looking at what the differences are between those who succeed in a bar movement and those who fail. And the first obvious thing to do was to look at the type of hearing aids, because there are some doctors who say, okay, I will give your child a cochlear implant, he will be fixed. And they use these terms. So is it indeed the case that all the children with cochlear implants are fine and the children with hearing devices, hearing aids, are not fine? No. In the excellent syntax group, we had children with hearing aids and children with cochlear implant. This was not the source of the difference. So maybe it's the depth of hearing loss. So we tested children with moderate, profound, and severe hearing loss. So maybe the more deaf the child is, the less syntax they have. So again, no, this is not what we find. So there were children who were very, very good with profound hearing loss and children who had impaired syntax with moderate hearing loss. So what is it that differentiates between the ones who succeed and the ones who don't? The very sharp difference between the groups was whether or not they received language exposure during the first year of life. So the difference was whether they had hearing aids or a cochlear implant during the first 12 months, or whether they received their hearing aids or cochlear implant later than 1 year of age. That was the very sharp difference between the two groups. And what I want to suggest is that it shows that there is a critical period for the acquisition of syntax in your first language. So I'll just show you the numbers, so you'll get as convinced as I am. These are the children with early exposure. 23 of them had intact syntax, and only 2 had impaired syntax. This is more or less the percentage in the population. When you go to a normal, typically hearing children's class, around 7 to 10% have syntactic problems. But you can see that the vast majority have intact syntax. When you go to the late exposure children, so the children who received hearing aids or cochlear implants after the age of 1 year, only 5 of them had intact syntax and 39 of them had impaired syntax. And if you want it in percentages, these are the percentages. So it's a huge difference between 92% good syntax with early exposure and 11% good syntax with late exposure. And even the ones who were fine in the late exposure are sometimes marginal. So we decided that they had to fail in 2 tasks in order to be counted as impaired syntax. So some of them were impaired in 1 task. But the difference is very clear. Actually, the same we found in Palestinian Arabic, though with a smaller group of children. Remember that they had, as a group, they had difficulties in object relatives and object questions. And what we saw is that most of the children in this group were received their hearing aids or cochlear implants after the age of 1 year. So only 17% of them had a good A-bar movement. And this is in comparison to the 10 who had early exposure, 6 of whom had very good syntax. Okay, so again, there is a difference. And it's just we don't have many children with early intervention. Maybe now we will have more, but the difference is very clear. So if we go back to the critical period, what we see is that there is a critical period for the acquisition of syntax in the first language. Why? Because if the children did not get any hearing devices during the first 12 months, and the family and parents were speaking only a spoken language, they were not exposed enough to language. They did not have sufficient language input. Right? And if there is a critical period during the first year of life in which you have to receive language input to start this critical period, to open the critical period, then if you do not get the language exposure you need, you might miss it. And I just want to stress that it's quite different from what we usually talk about when we talk about, not we, but there are people who talk about critical period for language, and usually it's the question, okay, I go on sabbatical. Until when can I go on sabbatical with my children and they will acquire French without an accent, right? Or acquired English without an accent, right? This is what we are usually talking about when we talk about critical periods. And for this, there is a lot of work on critical periods for language, but usually it is a critical period for a second language, right? So if a child has acquired already their mother tongue and they go abroad with their parents on sabbatical, until when can they acquire phonology or syntax of the second language as a native speaker? And for this, there is a completely different timeline. So when Lenneberg was talking about a critical period, he was talking about the critical period began in 2 years and ended in puberty. If you look at the various, and there are many studies on critical period for language acquisition, you see all kinds of ages, 9, 12, 13, 15. And recently there was a study on 669,498 children, English speakers, where the number was 17.8. So the end of the critical period was the age of 17.8, and then there was another study reanalyzing their data and saying, no, it's not 17.8, it's 18.6. But whatever this the size of this critical period is, it's not the exact same critical period as the one that I'm talking about. It's a critical period for the acquisition of another language once you have acquired a first language already. Now, going back to the mechanism, what does it mean that why is this exposure to language so critical in these 12 months? So what I want to suggest is that the critical period just doesn't open. So in order for, there is a lot of work on mice and other species about how exactly the critical period opens. And what I think is happening is that they need language exposure, sufficient language exposure, in order to open the critical period. And if the critical period is not open, if the brakes are not relieved, then the critical period doesn't even start. Okay, so this raises several questions. It raises a question about what happens with children who were not deaf when they were born, but they lost their hearing later. Or what happens when the children have language input, but just not spoken language input. They receive sign language as an input. And what happens if a child receives language input, but just in one ear? What happens with the critical period in these cases? So, So let's start with the progressive language impairments. So if we start with this, we had 7 children. We did not mean to do that, but we tested these children and we only later took their files, and we realized that these 7 children had progressive hearing impairment. So they were in the first year, they were hearing well, and then the hearing deteriorated for various reasons. So the question is, how do they perform in these syntactic tasks? because they did have language input during the first year. And look how beautiful this is. This is percent correct. Wonderful. They are able to understand and produce structures with A-bar movement. So they did get language exposure during the first year of life. Their critical period opened. They were able to acquire syntax or this kind of syntax. What about the difference between hearing loss in one ear and hearing loss in 2 ears? Is language exposure in only one ear enough? Because you know, in the educational system in Israel, they are considered the ones who have hearing loss in one ear, they are considered hearing impaired. Are they hearing impaired in the relevant meaning for the acquisition of syntax in the first language? So we compared this, we did it in Palestinian Arabic, 20 children with bilateral hearing loss, 20 children with monaural hearing loss, and 20 hearing controls. And what you can see here, okay, the light blue is the hearing controls. The pink are the ones with hearing loss only in one ear. And the orange are the binaural. And in the orange, you can see what we saw so far. They have problems with object relatives. They have problems with object questions. This is the orange. Now look at the pink. The pink patterns with the blue. So the children with hearing loss only in one ear, they behave like the hearing ones. So it is enough to hear in one ear in order to open the critical period. Now we try to think about whether there is a difference between hearing loss in the right ear and the left ear, but we don't have data yet. Now I must say that this is another picture of structures with movement and structures without movement in general. I must say that in production, they were not as perfect as the hearing children. They had some difficulties in production, so it's not completely pink, the picture. But in comprehension, they were completely patterning with the hearing controls. Okay, and now for the question of sign language. So when we look at children who were born deaf, but they received immediately when they were born, they started receiving language, sign language, from their families, from their deaf families. What happens in this case? Does sign language open the critical period? So this is a study that we did with Neta Chalutz and with Doron Levy, who are my PhD students. Doron Levy is a deaf person, a signer from birth. His parents are signers from birth. His daughters are signers from birth. And what we did was testing children and adults who use sign language as their main language of communication, but they also speak Hebrew. And we tested for A-bar movement structures in Israeli sign language. So this is a study with the 26 native signers. And that includes the adults and also adolescents in schools. And you cannot imagine how excited they were when we came to test them in schools. And instead of testing them in Hebrew, where they are usually tested, we tested them in their mother tongue. In sign language, they were really happy to participate in this kind of test. And our task was, first of all, to identify which structures in Israeli sign language are relevant. So which structures in Israeli sign language have this kind of movement, A-bar movement of one DP across the other DP. And what we found were several structures. First of all, we looked at WH questions. So for example, in Israeli Sign Language, you can ask a subject question with a duplication. So who bite cat who? Right? So the who moves to the end of the sentence, duplicates to the end of the sentence, so we have a kind of intervention structure, but you could also ask the exact same question without duplication. So we have a perfect minimal pair of structures with movement and without movement. And also for the subject questions, subject which questions, we have a structure with movement that we can compare to object questions that is actually a structure without movement. So you can see Doron asking a which question, a subject which question, which is the one with intervention. I'll show you again. Dog bite, cat, dog which. Okay. And then we ask whether these children who were born deaf but received sign language input, whether they were able to understand structures with movement. And this is the happy result here. So you can see that both in subject and object who questions and subject and object which questions, they were completely fine. They understood these structures without any problem, and we could not, for example, this minimal pair of subject questions with reduplication and without reduplication, there was no significant difference between the two. There was also no significant difference between which subject questions that involve movement and which object questions that do not. So, what does it mean? It means that if they receive language input during the first year of life, even if it's a sign language, it opens their critical period and they are able to acquire syntax. The same with other structures. I will not go deeply into this, but there are structures like subject pseudocleft. There are structures of topicalization. In all these structures, understood? Can you point to the right picture? I'll do it again. Grandma. Pinch who? The girl. Okay, this is a subject cleft. It's a structure with intervention, but still, when the adults and children with hearing impairment who were exposed to sign language saw these structures, they had no problem. So no problem in understanding structures with A-bar movement and intervention. What does it mean? It means that any natural language will do during the critical period. It doesn't matter what language it is. It doesn't matter if it's spoken or signed. But there has to be sufficient language exposure during the first year of life. And just and this is more anecdotal because it's only three of these deaf signers. We also tested them in Hebrew, and they were perfect. So it means that if they acquire, it doesn't matter, Hebrew is their second language, but they were fine in these structures. Now I felt that I was giving you a lot of actually sad stories, right? Because these are many children who struggle and who have difficulties. So I wanted to say something that will make you a bit happier. And this is about studies that both Ronit and Manar did with treatment of these structures. And I'm very happy to tell you that both Ronit and Manar, Dr. Ronit Sterman and Dr. Manar Khadadkhana, are in the Ministry of Education in charge of language of children with hearing impairment. So Ronit is in charge of language assessment, and Manar is in charge of all language in the Arabic-speaking population in Israel. And they are really making a revolution, a syntactic revolution in the Ministry of Education. And one of the aspects of this revolution is not only assessing these children, but also teaching them syntax. So this happens both at the single child level, but also in classes. So you can see here, for example, a class of hearing of deaf children. Actually, this is a class of people who sign and also use Hebrew. And you can see us trying, you can already identify the pictures that we show them. And they are very, very excited about these classes, even though it's in Hebrew, but they feel that it's very difficult for them to cope with these structures. And what we do is teach them syntax. I'll show you in a second how. And by the end of this intervention, of classroom intervention, they are all, we ask them, show me the hippo that the boy is drying, and they all raise their hands. Okay, I hope you can see that they raise their hands. So how does Ronit do it? She always goes with a very big bag of markers, and you can see that there is a marker for a marker for the agent, a marker for the theme, and a marker for the verb. And the children are actually marking the verb, and they are marking the movement. So they are really studying how to, really studying syntax, and they identify, after they identify where the movement was from, they identify the agent and they identify the theme, after we teach them some argument structure. So we talk about the verb. Okay, this verb is love. So in the, for the verb love, you have someone, you have to have someone who loves and someone who's being loved, right? Now let's try and find them in the sentence. And what you can see is this is the results of the school level intervention. You can see that there were most of the children improved, some of them only in comprehension, some of them both in, or only in production, some both comprehension and production, and there were very few children who showed no improvement at all. And when we look again at the group level, you can see the before and after, before in pink, after in light blue, and you can see that almost actually in all structures, you can see improvement. So it is possible, it's true, that it's very sad to be missing the critical period stage, but with the right treatment, they can, they don't get there like the others, but they improve considerably. So this is about treatment. Do I have time to do the thiamin or should we? Okay. Okay, so, and so now this was the whole issue of no language input during the first year of life. I want to add another group, looking at another group, where language input was not the problem, but the problem was the brain development. So this is another source of syntactic impairment. This is a very important molecule, thiamine, vitamin B1. And it is involved in various mechanisms in the brain. It plays a very crucial role in the cerebral metabolism, the metabolism of the brain. It serves as a cofactor for several enzymes in the carbohydrate catabolism, etc. It is important for neurotransmitters. It's important for membrane structure. It is an important vitamin. Now, the problem with this vitamin is that it depletes after 2 weeks. So if we do not consume enough of this vitamin, after 2 or 3 weeks, it is not stored in the body, and then there is not enough thiamine. The story is a very sad story of a group of children, quite a large group of children in Israel, who were consuming this kind of baby formula in 2003. And it turned out, so children started arriving in the ER with neurological symptoms, babies with neurological symptoms, and nobody knew exactly what was happening. There were 20 children at the time in ERs across Israel, and then a very perceptive child neurologist said, it looks like Korsakoff syndrome. And Korsakoff syndrome is a syndrome of alcoholic, usually of alcoholics who do not have vitamin B1, and she gave the child in her care B1, and he started to improve. And then there was an inquiry across all Israel, and they found out that indeed all these children were consuming this specific type of baby formula that for some reason the thiamine was taken out of. So on the box it still says vitamin B1, but they took the vitamin out of this formula for some reason. And so this is Aviva Fatal, this is the child neurologist, and this is Iris Fatal, my PhD student with whom we did this study. And what we were following this group of children since they were four. When they were four, Aviva Fatal came to my office and said, something is wrong with their language. I heard you have tests. And I said, yes, I have tests. What kind of problem do they have? She said, what do I know? I'm a neurologist. And then I started letting her hear all kinds of syntactic impairments, children with syntactic impairments, children with phonological impairments, children with lexical impairments. And when she heard the syntactic impairments, just a recording of a child with the syntactic impairment, she said, I think this is this one. Okay, and she was right again. And what we did was we tested these children when they were 5 with syntax and lexicon and conceptual abilities, and we later tested them when they were 8, and we added reading and IQ tests. We tested them when they were 15 and 16, and we now they are 18. And now we are testing them again, and we also added a part of morphology, and we follow them along the line. I will not tell you about, but it was not very different in the different stages that we tested them, so I'll just give you a picture of one stage when they were at second grade. And what we could see is that 97% of them had syntactic deficits. 97%. And this is in comparison to controls who have between 7 and 9%. So this vitamin B1 deficiency caused a very severe language impairment. And you already know the structures. So they had difficulties in object questions, and they had difficulties in object relatives, and they had difficulties in producing object relatives, and they had difficulties in repeating structures with A-bar movement with intervention. So what we see is that there is a dietary factor, vitamin B1 deficiency, that also can give rise to this kind of very specific syntactic impairment. Now, something that is quite important here is that when you look at adults with TMN deficiency, so Korsakoff syndrome, for example, individuals who usually, due to alcoholism, have depleted their B1 storage, they have problems with memory, but they don't have problems with language at all. So why is it the case that adults who have the exact same deficit do not have problems with syntax, and children do? My solution, I think, would be critical period. So if there is B1 deficiency during the first, this very sensitive period, the first year of life, then syntax might be impaired later. If the TME deficiency is after the brain has developed, then it affects memory, but it doesn't affect syntax. So again, we see the critical period here, not with respect to language exposure, but with respect to brain development. One final thing that I should stress is that it's not that all their languages was impaired. When we look this, each line, each row is a child, and each column is a different domain. So this is syntax, lexical retrieval, phonological work in memory, and conceptual abilities. And what you could see is that almost all of them have syntactic impairment of this kind of A-bar movement with intervention, but 22 of them don't have a problem in lexical retrieval, and 33 of them don't have a problem in phonology, and almost all of them don't have a problem in conceptual abilities. So the deficit that results from B1 deficiency during the first year of life is very specific. It is specific to syntax, and it is specific to this kind of syntactic structures of A-bar movement. What does it mean for critical periods? It means that critical periods are domain specific. So it might be that the first 12 months of life are sensitive to A-bar movement, and it might be that there is a different window that is sensitive to the lexicon and a different window that is sensitive to phonology, etc. So we see a very tight relation between vitamin deficiency and syntax, and we see that it's domain specific. And here I will just summarize. What we see here is that there is a critical period for the acquisition of syntax of a specific structure of A-bar movement with intervention during the very first year of life. And we see that children need sufficient language exposure during this first year of life, either spoken or sign language. And we see that it's modular. So it is a very specific kind, domain can be impaired, while other domains like lexicons and phonology are not. And here I finish, and I say happy summer solstice.